Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
Hello, it's the 16th of February and you are here for another episode of Give the People What They Want with Zoe and myself from People's Dispatch. Vijay is on a reporting trip somewhere in Europe, so he'll be joining us next week with fresh updates from the continent and movements there and hopefully other parts of the world as a whole. It's been, as usual, a very intense week for all of us covering news, for all of us covering the situation in Palestine, the situation in West Asia as a whole, especially as many of you would have read at this point, the big question is what happens in Rafah, in the southern part of Gaza, which where more than a million, maybe close to around 1.3 to 1.4 million Palestinians are in a very, very small part of the larger territory that is Gaza. And these 1.3 to 1.4 million, a large part of these people were forced into Rafah because of the brutal Israeli attacks since October 7th. We know that during these attacks, Israelis told the Palestinians time and again that move to the south of the territory, move to the south of the territory, because this part will not be safe. And now we have a situation where Israel is planning an offensive on Rafah. Now, of course, there's been widespread condemnation of the idea. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, all the aid organizations that you can think of, all of them warning against the kind of attack that is there, the possibility of an offensive on Rafah because of the sheer density of population over there. Now, it does look like there is a very concerted effort on the part of Israel over here to push people out of Rafah. In fact, that has always been, many media reports have indicated that that is really the plan, that you push the Palestinian people out of Palestine, because, you know, that really completes that agenda of ethnic cleansing that has always been so central to a lot of what Israel has been doing. And this is even worried countries like, for instance, Egypt, which is worried about Palestinians being forced to come into their territory. Egypt has even warned that it will scrap its 1979 peace agreement with Israel over this. And despite all these concerns, despite, you know, especially the horrible medical, the humanitarian situation in the region, these attacks have continued unabated. We have carried on People's Dispatch quite a few reports, especially on the health situation in Gaza. I would encourage you to read those reports, which really talk about how horrendous the situation is. Over the past few days, we have heard of continuous attacks on Nasser Hospital, for instance, in the Khan Yunis region, on the Al Amal Hospital. Nasser Hospital, one of the most important medical facilities in Gaza at this point of time. Israeli forces have called for the evacuation, have ordered the evacuation of patients over there, of thousands of people who are taking shelter, of medical personnel. For instance, you have a medical agency saying that they're not being able to get in touch or access these hospitals at all, even for delivery of aid. Their staff working in extremely, extremely difficult conditions. And in between all this, you have this continuing offensive, which has not stopped short. And it's very important to, of course, note that throughout this period, Israel's Western allies have been making maybe cautionary noises at most. The United States, of course, beginning by seeming to take a clear stand on this issue, or at least making expressions of concern, but its own position is diluted considerably, even from that low baseline where it started. So now it's talking about making sure that there are not too many casualties, as if in all this time that has really been Israel's concern. So a very, very dangerous situation not only in Gaza, but also the fact that across the region, it's been escalating. We have had attacks in Lebanon. Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah delivering two speeches this week, where he's been talking about, he's been being cautious in terms of how he's responding, but also making it very clear that, there is no endless patience as far as the Lebanese are concerned. So a region as a whole, dangerously and delicately poised at this point of time. One can argue that not much, that has been the case for many months now, but especially if the offensive on Rafah takes place, the extent of disaster might be really difficult to describe. And I think it's really a very damning testimony of the fact that despite all this talk about peace, despite all this talk about human rights, there's been absolutely no action, decisive action. Not even one Security Council not even one Stern Security Council resolution asking Israel to stop the war. So that's unfortunately where we are with the war on Gaza at this point.
Well, what's interesting, Prashant, I think, is that actually the threat and really the ongoing attacks on Rafah, because we know that there have been airstrikes carried out against the region, is that actually a lot of Israel's key allies have actually taken a position in calling Israel to back down, to call for a ceasefire, not even saying just a truce. I mean, we're hearing Emmanuel Macron of France, Australia, New Zealand, Canada releasing a statement calling for a ceasefire. This, and it's really because they're seeing the levels of the humanitarian suffering, the catastrophe. I mean, there's just countless reports that are just documenting and detailing kind of every level of the suffering. And even that doesn't go far enough into understanding what's happening on the ground, you know, as you mentioned. But it is interesting because, again, we see many more voices coming out and condemning Israel, again, even close allies. However, beginning of this week, no surprise here, the U.S. passed its long-awaited funding bill in the Senate, which essentially promises to send $14 billion to Israel. And this is, of course, extremely crazy, because not only is Israel sort of threatening this major escalation, is a moment when people are actually taking stock and saying, this is too far. 4 months into the genocide, 30,000 people slaughtered cruelly, and the U.S. actually pushes forward by saying we need to arm Israel more, we need to send more aid. And again, as we've talked about on the show, this is completely in contradiction to the sentiments of the people in the United States. I'm not just talking about, you know, the people who are on the streets protesting, which is a huge number, but major polls have said that the majority of U.S. adults actually don't support Israel's military campaign. They think Israel has gone too far. And again, the polls of like young people, the more specific age bracket, are much higher numbers. But the majority of American voters, adult age, do not support what's happening. And so we see U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer, who's actually based, is from New York, pushing this through. He's one of the biggest defenders of Israel. This bill now goes, of course, to the House of Representatives in the United States, Republican dominated. Many people think it's unlikely to pass because there's pretty strong opposition to sending more aid to Ukraine. And that's a major piece of this, you know, foreign funding bill. But still, the fact, you know, all of these actions send a message. It's saying, Israel, it doesn't matter that you're about to invade a land where there's over a million refugees, we're still going to send you military aid. And again, despite, as you said, all of these condemnations from human rights organizations, despite even leaders of the global north condemning what's happening, calling for a ceasefire, the fact that the United States just continues to financially and militarily back, and politically and diplomatically, which is, I think, is really crucial, back Israel, means that it feels like it can go ahead with these genocidal operations, this, you know, extreme violence against the people. So it's really atrocious that the United States is just continuing pushing forward. I think we have seen a little bit of cracks in the Biden administration. We've heard kind of these leaked rumors from staffers saying, oh, Biden's really furious with Netanyahu. Oh, Biden's this, Biden's that. He's unhappy with what's happening. But at the end of the day, their actions and their concrete policies have not changed. And we even saw a spokesperson saying that, you know, if Israel, they don't plan to punish Israel for any of the crimes that it's going to be, that it is carrying out and that it could carry it on Rafah. So pretty bleak situation, but I think that people continue putting pressure on the Biden administration, and it continues to be more and more politically costly for him to blindly back this genocidal regime. Again, election year, he's actually significantly losing large swaths of the population over this. So I think sooner or later, we're going to see this come to a head.
Right. So election year, something we have talked about often on this show, 2024, very vital for a number of countries, the United States being one of them, but that's much later in the year after a grueling process of primaries, where I think many of these questions are definitely going to come up. Although, unfortunately, there is definitely considerable unanimity between the Republicans and Democrats on the issue of Israel. But nonetheless, moving on going to the other side of the globe, so to speak, another vital election taking place on the 14th of February. And it's interestingly an election that is called the largest single day election in the world. That's Indonesia, you know, which has a very important country for multiple reasons. One being the fact that it's, of course, an economic powerhouse. It plays a key role in global affairs as a spokesperson for that region as a whole. There's a lot of weight it has. And this election particularly important because of the fact that after two terms, incumbent President Joko Widodo was no longer eligible to contest this election, although he continues to remain quite popular. And so after 8 years, the field was kind of thrown wide open for a variety of candidates. Now, this has been a curious election. First of all, of course, the results are not out yet officially. They'll only come out by the 20th of March, if I'm not mistaken. But the preliminary results, which were also what was anticipated by everybody, was that Prabowo Subianto, old war horse, so to speak, of the Indonesian political scene, would emerge as the winner. He's already declared victory. Right now, estimates say that he's getting about 57-58% of the vote. Prabowo was, interestingly, Jokowi's opponent, the incumbent president's opponent for the past two elections, which he lost. But this time, he is contesting with Jokowi's son as his vice presidential candidate, a very young man. And this itself is kind of indicative of the very mixed ideological and political scenario that, you know, led these elections, where Jokowi, who was traditionally a candidate of what is considered, you know, a far more moderate party, so to speak, switched his support to Prabowo, or they moved closer together, which has been happening for quite some time now. Unfortunately, Prabowo has a very alarming record. In fact, he is the son-in-law of former dictator Suharto, during whose time innumerable amounts of brutalities took place against activists, against the left, against protesters, you know, the massive corruption, massive violations of human rights. And Prabowo was in the thick of many of these violations, was directly responsible for them. In fact, he was dishonorably discharged from the Indonesian army. But all these years later, he has managed some kind of an image rehabilitation, so to speak, where he's been sort of turned into this affectionate, at least that's how the media portrays him in many parts of this thing, and the kind of an affectionate, elderly, wise, old man. And there's been very little examination during this campaign of his very brutal record during the Suharto era. And so it looks all set that he is likely to become the next president. So we're seeing another leader from that category sort of coming to power, although it's definitely going to be complicated. Like I said, Jokowi, because of his son, will continue to sort of exercise some amount of power in the new structure. It's going to be interesting to see how these two, while they are, while they are together, how long, what will be the fate of this alliance of former rivals. Very important to see in the parliamentary elections. The party which is a moderate one, Jokowi's former party, has done relatively better. So it's a bit unclear. Of course, final results will be out only in March, on the 20th of March, I believe. But this election was one also where I think that there was a considerable amount of consolidation of the ruling class. Quite a few issues raised by the left, quite a few issues raised by the activists, including the treatment of labor, including workers' rights. The question, there was the omnibus bill, which saw some massive protests in previous years, which really attacked workers' rights. Issues like that not really coming up so much in the Indonesian elections. So which analysts say tended to be far more personality driven than ideology or issue driven at this time. And a lot of issues that were raised by leftist and activist sections of society not really making it onto the agenda. So in a sense, it could be analyzed as some kind of a populist victory on this side, but remains to be seen where Subianto and the alliance he sort of cobbled together will go in the coming weeks and months as well. And we'll, of course, know the results fully by the 20th of March. But very important times. The agenda he's going to set forward will be very vital for the entire region as a whole.
Well, again, yeah, we love elections here. And this year is another vital election that will be taking place in Venezuela. Date to be confirmed, but could be as early as June. However, a familiar enemy has come up, which is the United States, once again cracking down on Venezuela regarding elections, criticizing Venezuela's democratic process. We know that during the pandemic, because of the US's desperation to actually get access to oil following the war in Ukraine, it turned to Venezuela. It started to recognize in some way, not officially, but the leadership of Nicolas Maduro, who is the president of the country. And we saw actually a lot of the sanctions that had been in place on Venezuela's oil industry start to loosen. And a process began where the US began to recognize some of the diplomatic efforts that Venezuela was leading, or some of the kind of reconciliation efforts it was leading with the opposition. And through the agreements that took place during the dialogue with the opposition, the US in turn started to loosen these sanctions. Agreements were made about the US having access to Venezuelan oil, in terms of repairing some of the machinery that they have. We know that because of the really heavy sanctions, it's actually really hard for Venezuela to even process their own oil. And so we saw this loosening up process, which in turn, of course, helped boost the Venezuelan economy. It's very, very positive steps, because we know that for almost 7 years, the U.S. had an extremely, extremely hostile position towards the United States, which began with Obama's declaration of Venezuela as an extraordinary and unusual threat, but intensified around the 2015 elections. And so once again, at the end of January, following the Supreme Court ruling that, again, the Venezuelan candidate Machado was not eligible to participate in the electoral process this year, and this is because, no less, she helped lead essentially coup efforts in the country. The violent uprisings against the government in 2014 and 2017, very intimately linked to this U.S.-backed efforts to really overthrow the government, which happened at the same time that the U.S. is exerting this maximum pressure campaign on Venezuela's economy. And so it had already been clear from the start this person would not be eligible to participate in the democratic process, again, just given the constant attacks to, Venezuela's sovereignty, its electoral system, its democracy. And so once this ruling came out that Maria Corina Machado would not be eligible to participate in the elections, immediately the Treasury Department said that it would resume the sanctions that had loosened on Venezuela. And it gave the deadline of February 13th for U.S. companies to cease doing business with Venezuela. And with the first target was the mining company. But again, the sanctions have continued. And essentially, this sort of, silent but soft attitude towards Venezuela, and like, because that rose out of necessity, has now been completely shifted. And we're seeing more and more U.S. officials talking about the threats to democracy, talking about how this is a rigged electoral process, talking about the dictatorship. Again, the same script that we've seen many, many times. And so it is definitely a tense moment and a tense year for Venezuela, because, again, any time there's an electoral process, this comes up. There's criticisms to the democracy, criticisms to the process. And now, especially, there is, this has become a right-wing talking point, because there's more immigrants actually coming from Venezuela, the southern border. So that has been worked into this whole right-wing and, honestly, Democratic Party tirade against Venezuela. Pressure is continuing to increase, and I think it's going to continue to increase around the electoral process. What will those sanctions look like by then? unclear, but Venezuela is once again in sort of the eye of U.S. empire and it's of course a plan to save democracy across the world.
Right, the plan to save democracy, an unending plan stretching decades. That is sort of I think by this point they're just drinking their own Kool-Aid. So this is a give the people what they want. We come to you every Friday. You can also listen to us as a broadcast. We bring you news from around the world, news of struggles, news of elections, like Zoe pointed out, news of, I think, developments that often sometimes don't really feature so much in the headlines. And one of them is probably a particular incident that took place today, that is in India, that is the Grameen Bandh, that is a rural shutdown, so to speak. Probably not at all going to be reported by most media across the world. And this rural shutdown was conducted by farmers and workers organizations across the country on a series of demands. Now, also important to note that there is also an ongoing farmers' protest in the state of Punjab, or rather the border between the states of Punjab and Haryana. Those farmers also presenting very similar demands as the protesters in other parts of the country today. And I think to understand it, we need to sort of take a deeper look at the agricultural condition in the country right now. India also important because India also going for elections in maybe, I think, now a month and a half. Probably we're going to see the first round of elections taking place. But the agricultural scenario is not, the product of one round of elections, or it's not an issue that has just started right now. We're talking about a decades-long process whereby agriculture has become increasingly unprofitable. Various reforms introduced by successive governments have attacked the foundations of agricultural production itself, making it increasingly unprofitable and with very low remuneration for farmers across the country. Many, many farmers, hundreds and thousands of farmers, have been pushed, unfortunately, into suicides. I think the number is just 400,000 or something in the last 10 years or so. So we're looking at a massive agrarian crisis, a huge amount of people leaving their farmlands, their agricultural pursuits, coming to the city, forced to take jobs that pay very menially. So it's also not just a crisis that of the rural sector, it's also a crisis that extends into the urban sector as well. So all this, despite all this, or in the face of all this, farmers' organizations across the country have made a very series of very clear demands to governments over time, to this government. One of the key demands being the question of what is called the minimum support price. They want a sustainable minimum support price. The minimum support price is the price at which the government procures crops from farmers. The Indian government does buy considerable amounts of crops, especially paddy from farmers, other products also. So they have asked for an expansion of that minimum support price, an increase in that price, so that agriculture becomes far more profitable and sustainable for them. And this was one of the key demands that also was very central to the very historic farmers' protests of 2 years ago. Many of you must have remembered those visuals, that those protests were also against the farm laws, which the government was forced to withdraw. But at that time, the government had said that they would set up a committee to consider this minimum support price. But as you can expect, that never really materialized. So once again, we have farmers from the state of Punjab, especially, moving towards the national capital, Delhi, where much before they reached, massive barricades were set up. There's been an incident of tear gas being fired at the protesters today. Huge barricades have come up in many places, restrictions on protests. Drones have been deployed to fire tear gas as well. So, a very definitely not a positive attitude towards farmers who are asking for, who are very basic and clear demands. And these demands, like I said, have been ongoing for many, many years. They have many other demands as well, but I think the MSP itself is a very central demand, which is not, which the government promised to consider, and now all this time later has still not positively considered. It's important to also remember that today's shutdown, for instance, is not a one-off. It's a result of a process that has been happening for many months. Farmers and workers have been conducting meetings and rallies across the country. There have been successive rounds of mobilizations. pressing that demand, making sure that that demand is very central to the kind of pressure they're applying to the government. And all this is one of those things we talk about. It's one of those processes of our time. It's not an event. It's not just one protest that we see today or one protest in November or whatever. It's a process of many, many years, which the farmers, the workers, those who are really not reported so much by the media, have been continuously pushing. So a very important story to watch out for, especially as India heads towards the elections.
Well, to close us off, I think I'll talk about another story, which we have been following, again, for the past couple of years, which is Ecuador, the situation in Ecuador, the sort of institutional breakdown. And this week, the government of Daniel Noboa ratified the military cooperation agreements with the United States. And so you might read that headline and say, wow, how did they get there? what led to this, clearly setback for its autonomy, for its sovereignty? As we have been covering, you know, it is the series, it is the result of many different policies that have been taken forward by prior governments, sort of the whittling way of the state infrastructure. And today we see this situation, which we spoke about in January, where this kind of outbreak of gang violence, of criminal violence sort of erupted. We saw these extremely, graphic and intense scenes of a gang sort of storming the headquarters of a TV station while they're broadcasting live on air. We know that there was several massacres that took place in the prisons and this sort of intense state of commotion shaking Ecuador. And, you know, this, again, is the result of many years of the deterioration of the state, of the involvement of key sectors of the ruling class in benefiting from drug trafficking that goes through Ecuador. Again, Ecuador is perfectly positioned to be part of the drug trade. It's between the two largest cocaine producers, Colombia and Peru. So the reactivation, the kind of opening for these gangs to kind of take hold in the country with this whittling down of institutions, even under neoliberal governments of Guillermo Lasso and Lenin Moreno, even the security institutions took hits. So even their budget was reduced, their personnel was reduced. So there's openings for these kind of groups to take hold. The demobilization of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia on the northern border of Ecuador, again, opened up this zone for another group to sort of assert its dominance. All of these factors led to this outburst that we saw in January, which, again, if you've been following Ecuador, the prison riots, the prison massacres have been happening for the past several years. Horrific violence. Hundreds of people have been killed in these prisons. The prisons were essentially under control completely of the gangs in the country. And this, again, came to its most intense expression when they literally took control and had prison guards hostage. And so in response to this commotion, Daniel Noboa declares a state of emergency, declares all of these groups as terrorist organizations, and begins this intense militarization of the country and crackdown on violent crime in the country. Since in the 37 days of what he's declared the internal armed conflict, over 1,000 people have been detained, have been put in prison. And at the same time, he said, anyone who wants to help us secure the country is welcome. And who do you think jumped at that opportunity? United States. And so this had already been taking place. Laura Richardson, the famous chief of the Southern Command of the U.S. Army, who just a year ago was saying on television, open for everyone, that Latin America was important because of the natural resources that are there. So again, the chief of the Southern Command a year ago was saying Latin America is important because of its resources. 1 year later, she's signing military cooperation, these military cooperation agreements are getting ratified. She was in the country in January. And I think it's important to point out just a couple of elements of these agreements. On one hand, there's going to be joint operations between the Ecuadorian Army and the U.S. Army in terms of the seas. And so they have essentially license to take part in you know, seizing ships, any sort of criminal activity that's happening out at in the water. There's also aerial interception, cooperation on the ground. And this is, I think, perhaps the most important point, is that there's a status of the armed forces to essentially have exceptions, immunity, privileges. They're allowed to be carrying their weapons and being dressed in U.S. military gear in the country. They're allowed to partake in all sorts of privileges, different tourist activities. So essentially, this is a huge threat again for Ecuador. We've seen when the doors are open to U.S. troops to use countries, military bases to integrate with their armed forces, nothing good comes of it. There's so many cases across Latin America itself of horrible crimes that have taken place by U.S. personnel in other countries. Rafael Correa had actually kicked U.S. troops out of the country. So this is a huge setback, something we definitely need to follow. U.S. imperialism does not rest for a minute. They're not too preoccupied in Palestine. They have actually, they're able to support a genocide and continue to try to, control Latin America. So we're keeping our eyes on Ecuador, of course, keeping our eyes on Gaza. You can check out all of our reporting on peoplesdispatch.org and on our social media platforms. Like the video, share it, and follow us every day for your movement-driven news and a perspective you won't get from the mainstream media.